Good morning, Calvary. My name is Weston Bauer. I serve in the men's mentorship ministry, and my family and I have been going to Calvary for almost 16 years now. Today's word will be from John 6, 1 through 21. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough to feed each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land in which they were going.
Thanks, Weston. Well, there is a trope, an often used storytelling device that I absolutely hate. I'm talking about when a movie or a TV show has been telling you a story and dropping hints along the way, and then you get right to the reveal, right before the conclusion, and it re-shows you all of the hints that they had been giving you. The screen oftentimes will go slightly blue because apparently the past was tinted blue, and then it shows you all the things that they've already shown you. They zoom in as if you weren't paying attention, or they're just trying to show you how clever they are. Like, did you see? Did you notice that we were telling you all these things all along the way? Yes. Yes, it was quite obvious that they were important since you kept showing it to us. Now, for example, someone is trying to solve a crime, and then they finally get a vital piece of evidence that they found a toothpick at the scene of the crime. And then it flashes back, the screen goes slightly blue, and it shows you all the times that this person interviewed someone and they had a toothpick in their mouth. And then the next time that they had a toothpick in their mouth. And the next time they had a toothpick in their mouth. And it's showing you all of this as a way to say, "Hey, did you catch it? You see we were doing this?" Yeah, you had what felt like a 15-minute close-up shot of a guy with a toothpick in his mouth. Of course I noticed it. I don't need you to hold my hand during this. I don't need you to re-show me this story. You've already demonstrated you're bad at storytelling. I don't need to relive it. I bring all this up because Emily's been watching a lot of Hallmark movies lately, and it's just been really impacting my mood. But I do bring all this up for a couple of reasons. One, it is a desperate cry for help. Can one of you convince her to watch something better? But second, unfortunately, I think this might be the best way to tell this story. This story in the Gospel of John is, dare I say, full of flashbacks. That John tells this story, and he does so where he's zooming in on details. He's zooming in on parts where it's as if the screen goes slightly blue and it's retelling you parts that came from before, parts from the Bible that we had already seen that John wants to have fresh in our mind as he tells this story in particular. He keeps zooming in on these details as if they're toothpicks for us to notice. Now, I say that this is a bit of a familiar story, and maybe it's not familiar for us. Maybe we haven't heard it before. I just mean familiar in the sense of the story of the Bible. We talk about how there is a certain genre of book called a gospel, this good news message of Jesus. And we have four gospels in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And John is a bit of an outlier there. He tells a story a bit different from those other three, where Matthew, Mark, and Luke have quite a bit in common. John writes predominantly differently than the rest to give us a more full understanding of the story, a bigger picture of who Jesus is. Now, there are a few miracles, a few teachings that Jesus does that's found in all four Gospels. But even as John includes this one that's found in all four Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000, he includes certain details that are unique, certain things that stand out from the other ways that this story is told, certain things that if we look at it, it's actually pointing us back to the larger story that God has done. John includes these little pieces in this story that I think are meant to be flashbacks for us, to look back at how God has worked in the past, where the screen goes slightly blue as we zoom in on a toothpick to get the larger story. Let me show my work. So in John chapter 6, we read that it starts off this way. It says, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. I think that's a toothpick. Like John, just as a bit of an aside, includes verse 4 there. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. No other gospel locates this at the Passover. John is uniquely doing that. Now, we've mentioned that John often talks about the feast of the Jews throughout his gospel, that Jesus is regularly teaching or doing miracles or doing some sort of work during these different festivals that the Jewish people would have. And it seems that every time Jesus does something at one of these feasts, what he's doing is directly related to what that feast is about. The work that he does reflects what that feast is about. And Passover, more than any other, was important to the Jews, and it seems more than any other is important to John, who wrote this gospel. Passover shows up three different times throughout the Gospel of John. Just a quick side note, this is a little throwaway for you. This is how we know how long Jesus' ministry was. If you ever hear people talk about Jesus had a three-year-long ministry, well, the reason why we know that is because there's three Passovers in the Gospel of John. That's how we know how long his ministry was. But Passover shows up multiple times throughout this letter. And whenever Jesus does a work on the Passover, it always has one meaning. He continues to have one message every time he teaches during the Passover. We've already seen one in chapter 2. Jesus is at the temple and he says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it again. And we aren't left wondering, like, what does he mean by that? Because John like immediately takes away any of the tension. And he says he's talking about his body, how he's going to lay down his life and be raised 3 days later. Passover is the setting for basically the whole second half of the Gospel of John. All of what's called the farewell discourse takes place around the Passover. So this is when Jesus gives things like the Lord's Supper, and he tells his disciples to keep this as a remembrance, to remind ourselves of his death. Whenever Jesus does a work at the Passover, he is always pointing to his upcoming death. We're going to see more of that next week, but it's helpful to keep that in mind as we read our passage today. Now we keep talking around Passover. I keep saying the word Passover, but what exactly is this feast? If John wants us to understand the feeding of the 5,000 took place during Passover, well, what is this Passover feast? Well, it all goes back to the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible. And in that, we see a situation where God's people were enslaved in a foreign country. They were slaves in Egypt, unable to worship him, unable to be with him in the way that God called his people to be. And so God promises in this book to do a work that only he can do. He will deliver his people. He will rescue his people. And he does so in a way that proves his superiority over the Egyptian gods. He does so in a way that shows that he is the one and only true God. He does so in a way that shows mercy and grace to his people. He does so in a way that leaves no one around wondering, how did this happen? It is clearly by his hand and his hand alone. God has been calling for his people to be released by Pharaoh, the ruler of Egypt, and Pharaoh continues to say no. And then we finally get to the most horrifying and the last step that God uses to draw his people out, where he says, I will enter into Egypt and take the life of every firstborn son. But in any place where God holds people accountable for their actions, for their lack of belief in him, he always provides a way out. He says, if anyone were to take a lamb and sacrifice that instead and put the blood of that lamb over their doorway, God will pass over that house. He will extend mercy to that house. And it's this final act that leads Pharaoh to say, go. And God rescues, God delivers his people from Egypt. From this important act, God called for the Israelites to keep this as a feast, to regularly have this Passover meal to remind themselves of the work that God did in delivering them. This comes from Exodus chapter 12, verses 14 and 15. No one comments on it. Man, we're doing a flashback. I blue tint the slides just for this moment. No one acknowledged it. What a, just wasted. Anyways, to the Bible, Exodus 12, verses 14 through 15. God is speaking. He says, this day shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast for the Lord throughout your generations as a statute forever. You shall keep it as a feast. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove all leaven from your house. For if anyone eats what is leavened from the first day until the seventh, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So God gave this feast as a way to remember what it is that the Israelites went through in slavery and went through in being delivered out to them. And it's in that context that John, rather than any other gospel writer, says when Jesus fed the 5,000, the Passover was at hand. This should stick out in our mind. We should see the screen going blue. This should be like a toothpick that we zoom in on and say, this is going to be significant. This is going to help us understand what Jesus is doing in this miracle. It happened during Passover. Well, as we continue in the story, Jesus is in this place. He goes to this mountain area, and he is asking, when he looks up and sees this great crowd around him, how will they feed this crowd that has been assembled? And it says that he does this, he asks this question as a way to test them. I think there's a toothpick there. Jesus is off by a mountain in the desolate place, testing his people. Well, it sure sounds like after the Exodus, God rescued his people. They're going through the wilderness at the base of a mountain, and they were tested, and they failed. They did not trust in God. What will God's people do now? He asks where they will get food for this crowd, and Philip, who is there, said, man, even if we had half a year's wages, we could not possibly feed everyone who's gathered here. And that becomes all the more true when we look at the number of the crowd that's given to us. It says there are 5,000 men gathered around Jesus. Now, men is what would have been counted as a way to say how many households are there. They would count the head of household, the man who's part of the house. But it's not telling us there's only 5,000. I mean, if everyone was married, does that mean there's 10,000 people in this crowd? They're married and have one kid. There are 15,000 people in this crowd. We don't know. We're just told this as a way to show it's a massive, massive crowd that's gathered around Jesus here. We pick up the story in John 6, verse 8. It says, one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a boy who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? They find this boy, which shows us it's not just men who's part of this crowd, and he has this small, very humble meal for himself. But what's given to us is the number that is here, that when you have 5,000 households represented, yeah, you only have 2 fish and 5 loaves. Not everyone's even going to get a snack. Makes me think of like that Mickey Mouse cartoon where they're impoverished and they're slicing bread and they slice it to where it's like transparent on the inside. That's how thin of a slice it is. It like gets blown away by the wind. Like we can't even feed anyone that much from 5 loaves and 2 fish. But it also tells us the quality of the food as well. That it specifically names them as 5 barley loaves. Well, there was a Jewish historian from around the time of Jesus, a little bit before Jesus, who references what these loaves were like. And he said these barley loaves were reserved for animals and men with little joy in their life. That is quite the description for what this meal entails. But it's given us both of these details, how much fruit is there and the quality of the food. That it's not Andrew coming with this tremendous faith of like, we've solved all the problems. This guy here has a small, really poor quality snack. No, he says, this is the best we can do. This is all that's around. And it's not enough. It's not good enough. What could you possibly do with something so insignificant? I think that's a toothpick. So it makes me think of the book of Exodus as God was calling Moses, this one who's going to do this work that God will deliver his people through him, that he chooses this man. He calls out to him from this burning bush and says, you will be the one to go to Pharaoh. You will be the one to free my people. And Moses has all the excuses in the world why it should not be him, why he is not the guy. Exodus chapter 4 says this in verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent, either in the past or since you've spoken to your servant, but I'm slow of speech and tongue. And the Lord said to him, who has made the man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, I will be your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. Moses says, oh, what could I possibly do? How could I be the one that you're going to work through when I am not eloquent enough? I'm not good enough. What could you possibly do with something so insignificant? He eventually continues to go back and forth with God saying, it's not me, I'm not good enough. It's not me, I'm not good enough. Send someone else. And God doesn't do that. He sends Moses. He does raise up his brother Aaron to go with him, providing what it is that he needs. But the same way this feeding of the 5,000 starts is what we see how this deliverance, how the Passover starts. God will call his people out of slavery through Moses. God will lead his people, deliver them through Moses. And it all starts with saying, it's not good enough. This isn't enough. Andrew comes before Jesus saying, what can we possibly do to feed people? The best we can do are these 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's not good enough. And yet the response of God in both of those instances is the exact same. With me, it's always enough. Jesus tells the crowd to be seated, and he takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and he prays over them, he blesses them, and begins to break off pieces to be distributed to the crowd, breaking and breaking and breaking to the point that every single person there had their fill. And not just their fill, but that each there was so much left over that it filled 12 baskets. That's a toothpick. I just don't have time to get into it. But we see that John is putting so much emphasis on this Passover setting. He's leaving details all throughout it that's supposed to sound familiar, that's supposed to make us go back in the story, that's supposed to help us to see what is happening through the very language that God had done before. And that is significant. Because it's only when we see that connection, when we see these flashbacks, when we see the toothpicks that are being zoomed in on, these detail pieces that matter so much, do we understand what it is that is happening in this story. The God who worked during the Exodus is the God who's working in this story. But again, John is writing this, not just to people who see this happen at the time, but John wants his readers to understand that very same thing. It's not just that God worked in the story of the Exodus. It's not just that God worked in feeding 5,000. That God who always had worked, who is working, will always work. The same God who delivered in the story of the Exodus delivers in this story and will deliver in your story as well. John wants to make a link between the fact that God has always been working, always been rescuing his people. He did so in the Passover, which we were supposed to take notice of. He's doing so here, which we are supposed to take notice of, so that we can know that God delivers still to this day. We miss that entirely if we don't see that connection John is making. If we don't go back to the Passover, have this flashback, we miss the emphasis that John is drawing out of it. Maybe we sit there saying, man, it's just one verse. He says that it's located at the Passover. This feels like it's reading far too much into the text. I don't think so. Because again, John isn't the most subtle in these things. He continues to draw this emphasis. And the way that he has been writing his gospel so far, it's really Moses-y, I guess I would say. All the way back in chapter 1, you have John the Baptist who's being interviewed, and they ask him this particular question, are you the prophet? Not a prophet, are you the prophet? One particular prophet. Well, that goes back to Deuteronomy, where after Moses dies, God says, I will raise up again a prophet like Moses. The expectation is that the prophet would someday come who would be like Moses. Still in chapter 1, we have Philip, who's mentioned in this story, talk to his brother and say, in Jesus, we have found the one Moses and the prophets wrote about. In John chapter 3, Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, and he references a story from the life of Moses as a way to tell what his upcoming death will be like. Right before this, in chapter 5, in fact, the very first, like the verse right before we go into the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus himself says, Moses wrote about me. The way the story of the feeding of the 5,000 ends is this crowd see the power of Jesus and they try to seize him, make him king by force. Not because they know of what Jesus will do, they just see power. They just see authority and they see, oh, this must be the prophet. Here is the new Moses. All throughout the story, there's been toothpicks. Time and time again, we've been hearing Moses, 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 Moses. And now we get to the story that takes place during the Passover. With all these other details that I just don't have time to get into, mostly because I don't know the significance of all of them, but all throughout this story, it sounds so much like the Exodus story. And the reason why I think John is doing this time and time again to build that expectation, God worked in the past, God worked in the story, we should expect to see God work in a similar way. Just as God delivered in the story of the Exodus, God delivers in this story. And God will deliver in your story. Now, with that, I'm sure comes questions like, how does God deliver in this story, the feeding of the 5,000? How does God deliver in our story as well? There's a few different ways that I see God's hand of deliverance here. The first and easiest one to see is God delivers from need. God delivers people from their needs. In the story of Exodus, God's people were slaves in Egypt, unable to rescue themselves, unable to get to the place that God had called them to be. So God is the one who comes and rescues them. Here he's surrounded by people who have been with him and now they're hungry and there's no place around to get food for this many people. There is a real tangible need that the people have and Jesus delivers them from that need. I don't know if I need to tell you what your needs are. We have so many of them. And maybe we don't have as clear of a moment of being sat down in the grass by Jesus as he hands us never-ending bread. But God is still that God who delivers people from their needs. God delivers people from faithlessness. God delivers from faithlessness. After the scene of the Exodus, God was leading his people to a land that he promised them, a land that would be their home, where he would be their God and they would be his people. But as they're walking through the wilderness, the first sign of trouble, the first hint of difficulty, the people say, it was better off when we were slaves. We should have never left. God, who had done this miraculous work to bring them from that place, they completely lost their faith in him. Or the disciples in the story, who have seen Jesus do countless miracle after miracle after miracle, have the slight inconvenience of where are we going to get food from? This God who's done so much in front of them, they have no expectation that he can do this lesser thing of care for those that he cares for. Where do we lack a trust in God? Maybe we say something like Moses, that I'm just not good enough, God. I can't do what you've called me to. I'm not eloquent. This is all that I have, and it's not enough. Or these disciples where the only person around is this boy who has the first century equivalent of Wonder Bread with him, and they don't see how saving could possibly happen. They lack faith yet again. Where do we lack trust in God? Where do we question where God can work through what we have? All right, God, this is all I've got, and I think you will acknowledge it's not good enough. This is all that I have. And God's response in the story of Exodus, in this story, and always is, with me, it's enough. God, you're calling me into a life of following after you, but I struggle with trust. My faith feels too weak. God, you call me to follow you, but it is hard. Or I'm stressed out about resources, finances. You call me to care for the people that you put in my life, and I just don't know where that care is going to come from. Or I don't feel like I have enough. God, you call me to make your name known to the world. Well, I don't have the words. I don't have the ability. I don't have the confidence to do that. And we stand there holding the little bit that we have in our hands and saying, it's not enough. It's not significant enough. It can't do anything. But God responds the same way he always does. With me, it's enough. Don't put your hope in what you can put in your hands. Put your hope in the God worth holding on to. Next week, we'll talk about how God delivers us from our sins. The ultimate exodus, the ultimate saving project. Just as God rescued his people from slavery, what they truly needed was to be rescued into life with him. Just as people are gathered around Jesus hungry, their greatest hunger is what is standing in front of them. God delivers his people from their sins. But there's one other place that I want us to focus on in the story. One other story of deliverance that we see here. God delivers his people from fear. In him, we have a God through which we can face no matter what life will throw at us because he is with us. In him, we have a God that we can navigate all of life's most difficult circumstances with because he is with us. In him, we have a God who's always has been working like he did in the Exodus, like he did in John 6, so we can know he always will be working. After this miraculous feeding, Jesus sees what the crowd is about to do, and as a way to save them from themselves almost, he retreats to a desolate place. The disciples are sent ahead of him. They're crossing over the sea once more, and as they're doing so, they actually find themselves in a terrifyingly violent storm. It's to the point that the disciples look around and they have no more hope. They have no more reason to trust. They think this is it. This is the end for them. And then it just gets compounded all the more as they see what must be a ghost, someone dead because they're walking on water. It is the most frightening thing. Clearly, this is the end of their life. And yet all of that fear is driven out with a very simple exclamation from Jesus. John chapter 6, verse 20. But he, Jesus, said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." And their fear is gone. Now, you may have picked it up if you've been around Calvary for a little bit. I rarely reference the Greek. So the New Testament that we have, it was almost entirely written in Greek to begin with. And the reason why I never bring up the Greek behind it is because I want us to have high confidence in the English translations that are in front of us. We have a really good English translation through which God can speak through. There are some times where it might not be the best way of phrasing things, and this is one of those times that I'm a little bit dissatisfied with the English that we have. Now, it makes sense why they do it. They're trying to make it so it's understandable. Jesus is on the water. He calls out to them. He's identifying that it is him, and he is the reason why they aren't afraid anymore. Jesus being with them is what rescued them from fear. So him saying, "It is I," that gets that idea across. There's only in Jesus being with them that they're no longer afraid. And yet, we miss a little bit of meaning in how it's translated. Because that first clause that Jesus has here, that first part of the sentence, which we have as written, "It is I," well, in the Greek, it's just two words that make that up. Two words that literally translate to I am. I am. Don't be afraid. And you better believe that's a toothpick. Exodus chapter 3, verse 13. It says, "Then Moses said to God, 'If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' And God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.'" He said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. And thus I'm to be remembered for all, throughout all generations.'" See, the very comfort that was given to Moses as he's struggling with this idea of God working through him, of him saying, "I'm not good enough for this. I can't possibly go." This source of fear that pops up from, "Oh, what do I say to the people even? They ask me, who is this God? I don't even know what to say." Well, God tells him his name, "I am." But that's not just a name. It tells us what God is like. This is the God who was and is and forever will be God. This is a God who's present with his people. I am. And since he is a God who's present with his people, Moses, you don't need to be afraid. I am. Don't be afraid. To the disciples in the boats, when all seems to be lost, the storm is just too much to navigate through. And these are fishermen, for the most part, who would have spent their entire lives on this very sea. If anyone could navigate it well, if anyone knows the twists and turns that the weather could throw at you, it's these disciples who are in this boat, but this storm is too much. We can't possibly make it through. We can't possibly survive. And then they see someone walking on water. Just the fear grips them. But it's all gone with a simple statement, "I am." That God drives out fear. No matter what it is that we're facing, no matter what obstacles seem before us, no matter what we think our limits are, no matter if we think something is too much for God to navigate through, that same statement is said because it's the same statement that God has always said. The God who worked in this way in the past continues to work in this way. The constant encouragement is yours when you find it in him. God says to people at the brink of despair, "I am. Don't be afraid. You're not alone. You're not defined by your limits. You're not lost in your circumstances. You're not swimming in despair. Things aren't going to capsize around you. You have a God who is active to this day with you." And if it takes flashbacks for us to understand that message, well, then I suppose it's worth it.